From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. This episode contains sensitive recounts of police brutality, racial trauma, and violence. Listener discretion is advised. There isn't a place most Black people go in America where they don't wonder, what would happen if I encounter the police? We've all seen the viral cases, being Black while driving, selling water, or watching birds in a park could transform a regular day into becoming a hashtag and the epicenter of a national news firestorm. Sadly, earlier this year, that became the reality just 86 miles west of Champaign, Urbana, for 36-year-old Sonia Massey, who called the police after she thought there was an intruder in her home. If we don't hear about the realities of these tragedies from loved ones trying to protect us with the talk or from Black culture, it's from news reports like this one.
We are learning new details about the body camera footage showing what prosecutors say led to a sheriff's deputy shooting and killing a Springfield woman in her home.
Former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson is facing several charges in the death of Sonia Massey, including first-degree murder.
Sonia Massey's family is still in a state of shock tonight, nearly a month after video of her death hit the internet.
Police body camera footage showed Massey handling a pot of water in her home when an officer drew his gun and shot her three times.
The reactions are emotional from Sonia Massey's family all the way to the White House. The video of her final moments is tough to watch. Not long after Grayson shot her, the other deputy says, "I'm going to go get my kit, his medical kit," to which Grayson responds, "No, it's a headshot. She done." Grayson, who was fired last week, has pleaded not guilty to several charges, including first-degree murder.
On the evening of July 6th, 2024, police in Springfield, Illinois, just over 80 miles west of Champaign-Urbana, became the latest city at the center of the issue of police brutality. Sonia Massey, a 36-year-old Black woman, had called 911 for help, fearing someone had broken into her home. Police showed up with the intent to search her home and conduct a check. Despite Massey being unarmed and showing no explicit threat, the situation inside her home escalated to the point when Sean Grayson, an Illinois deputy, shot Massey three times. She died on the spot, with Grayson denying his co-officer to provide any medical care. Unfortunately, police brutality against Black Americans isn't new, and many of us remember firsthand accounts of experiencing injustice by law enforcement, whose title is to serve and protect, or have heard the countless names of innocent Black civilians who have been killed or hurt across the country. Some being George Floyd in Ferguson, Elijah McClain in the Denver metro area, and even so far back as the brutal beating of Rodney King in 1991 by LAPD in Los Angeles. Violence from police officers against Black women in particular tends to get even less coverage by mainstream outlets. From cases like that of Sandra Bland and Breonna Taylor to now the loss of Sonia Massey, we're reminded of what Columbia University researcher and scholar Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, the creator of hashtag SayHerName campaign, says, that Black women so often get taken away without news coverage or justice. The latest on Illinois Deputy Sean Grayson is he was fired on July 17th of 2024. He's been charged with first-degree murder and currently held at the Menard County Jail. The Illinois State Police found that Grayson was not justified in his use of force. His lawyers are fighting for pretrial release, which means to let him out before the trial, claiming Grayson is undergoing cancer treatment. Sean Grayson's lawyers petitioned the court for his release twice, on July 18th and August 9th. Both petition attempts were denied. Today, we're starting off the conversation speaking with two African-American police chiefs in Champaign and Urbana, Chief Larry Boone of Urbana and Chief Timothy Tyler of Champaign, about their thoughts on what happened to Sonia Massey, how they lead their local police departments, and how they rebuild trust with communities that data shows do not trust law enforcement. Later on in the conversation, I sat down with PhD student and researcher Alicia Lewis, who studies both the data and impact of police violence in the Black community. Now, we sit down with Police Chief Larry Boone of Urbana to tell us more about his experience when he first started in the police academy and how he's navigated systemic racism with his passion in serving and protecting citizens where he has served across the country. Chief Boone, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. You've been police chief in Urbana for a year.
When you first stepped into your role, what were some of the things you had noticed or witnessed at first and then wanted to start implementing over time?
Immediately, one of the things I noticed that there wasn't a machinery to capture crime data. Where I'm from, I was used to meeting every day, capturing crime through a crime analyst and meeting as a team evaluating crime and what was happening in the city. Urbana had a process where it was somewhat not as formal. Some of the things I did immediately was institute a process where we are able to analyze crime daily, weekly, monthly, and make that information available on our website for public consumption. My philosophy is you hide nothing from the public, nothing. The days of that type of policing are gone by the way of the dodo bird.
How can Black communities experience trust with law enforcement?
You know, you do that by going into spaces that they aren't accustomed to seeing you at. I'm not just talking about enforcing the law. Mm-hmm. Showing up at events that they don't expect to see you at, showing up at churches, developing partnerships with those that are intimately involved with our children. For an example, we're looking at starting a police academy, a police athletic league. Mm-hmm. We don't have one, never had one here in Urbana, and it's an opportunity for our youth to see us in a different environment other than coming into their community, enforcing the law. Because what happens, unfortunately, over time, you start developing biases. And that goes both ways. That goes with that youth that may be in a position where he or she sees an officer go into the community and have to be in a position where they're using force, or you know, sometimes officers, because we're human as well, will start to develop biases as well regarding certain folks over time if we continue to go into their communities. And it's just important that we go into each other's spaces. But the heavy lift is on the uniform. Okay, we are a branch of the government. The reality is that there's a history of policing when it comes to the African American community that we have to embrace. It's on us. We have to go into those spaces and show that we are a different department.
Do you think the conversation on police brutality has died down after George Floyd?
Yes, I think it's died down, but anytime an event like the Sonia Massey, it stirs right back up, comes and goes. It never goes away. Okay, let's be clear about that. In the age of social media, there's always an incident where we aren't at our very best. That's unfortunately because I can tell you out of the millions of citizen contacts with law enforcement, they go the way they are supposed to go. But you don't see those.
Speaking of the history of policing in this country and the injustice that we've seen against many races, not just African Americans, what do you think some of those factors in the past have been to feed that systematic racism?
You know, when I first joined the police department, it was preached in the academy, them against us. It was preached, go home safely. Mm-hmm. And what happens by the time you graduate, you have this paramilitary mind that they or them are the enemy. You lack the empathy to deal with folks, particularly minorities, with empathy.
Where do you think our country's headed in terms of advancing racial justice?
Not as chief, mm-hmm. Okay, let me just say this as a African-American man. I'm concerned with respect to where we're going as a country Never have I seen so much vitriol surrounding folks that historically have not been naturally embraced. I think those in leadership have to be more vocal and not worry so much about their financial outcome. Leadership requires you to be brave. If you want to be police chief, governor, whatever the case may be, sometimes you have to say the obvious stuff that may impact you professionally. I give you an example. I sit here as the only African-American chief in the world to have ever held a Black Lives Matter sign and be photographed. And in that moment where I was challenged to hold the sign during the protests, I knew it will impact me professionally. I knew it. But at the same time, I knew if I didn't, that all the good social will that I had garnered that day during the protests would lead to violence. As a police chief, I think when we talk about social justice as it relates to Black and brown communities or those other communities such as LGBTQ+, we have to be bold and we have to say the hard stuff. People are looking for us for leadership during those moments of crisis. People know when you're faking it, and people expect you to respond to certain tragedies, whether certain oomph. With respect to Sonya Massey, that was criminal. That officer should have never been hired. Anytime an officer has multiple agencies within a short time period, that is a big red flag. One of the things police chiefs, not all of them, but some, we have to be more vocal about officers that don't do this job with dignity and respect, and particularly when we're dealing with those in the community that historically did not trust us or don't trust us.
Chief Boone, thank you so much for having this dialogue with me.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to the next one.
Coming up next on Dialogue, we're continuing our conversation on how police departments in Illinois are responding to the shooting of Sonya Massey and what impact their work is having on the communities they serve. Next, we'll be hearing from Police Chief of Champaign, Chief Timothy Tyler, about what led him into this work and what he hopes to do with this role now. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. This episode contains sensitive recounts of police brutality, racial trauma, and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we're continuing our conversation on the shooting of Sonya Massey and how two local African-American police chiefs are building trust with the Black community after generations of recounts of police brutality in America. We just heard from the police chief of Urbana, Larry Boone. Now we'll shift focus to Champaign and sit down with Police Chief Timothy Tyler of Champaign to hear his story and his thoughts on policing in the Black community. As a chief with the Champaign Police Department, I want to ask you, how have you been working with Black communities and their personal experience with law enforcement?
Yeah, so newsflash, I'm Black, so I've never not worked with the Black community. I don't know, it's just seamless to me because I'm pretty much involved in every organization that's in the Black community. I'm a member of the Phi Beta Sigma fraternity, so I spend a lot of times with my fraternity brothers. I'm a member of the Love Corner Church, so I spend a lot of time with Bishop Gwynn and my fellow church members there. I spend a lot of times with Black community members that are members of VFW, Black community members that are members of CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocate, Black community members that are member of Boy Scouts, so Black community members that are veterans. So I'm a member of the Black community. And Black community is a member of the entire community because we're interwoven in everything that we do. There is no America without African Americans being in a community.
Before you started in this career, if you're able to touch on a little bit of your own personal experience as a Black man in America and what it was like just trusting law enforcement to serve and protect us as a community.
Yeah, so I got lucky, right, because I grew up in a small town called Hazelhurst, Mississippi, and my uncle was a cop in the community. And I also had the distinct advantage of dating a young lady and her dad was a state trooper. So all I know is how loving and peaceful police officers can be. As a matter of fact, those two men in my life really pretty much told me how I was going to live life, especially Mr. Farish, the retired Mississippi state trooper. He pretty much said, you're going to get your associate degree. You're going to major in criminal justice. You're going to join the Army. You're going to be a military police. You're going to be a local police officer, and then you're going to join the state police. The only thing I have not done that Mr. Farish told me to do, that I didn't mimic him, is I don't have a German Shepherd named Apollo running around my house. That's how much that man means to me. So I am a direct reflection of law enforcement, Black law enforcement, that kind of raised me. And then when I got into law enforcement, it's been just a plethora of people that have poured into my career. One thing I'm really proud of are the women who have raised me to be a man. I'm a colonel in the United States Army because I had some tough female leaders that made me do my best, that didn't sugarcoat the standard, and that didn't give me passive. So I was with a wonderful leader, Major General Del Rosso. I just got back from my 2 weeks, and she's just got over breast cancer, and she's leading over 12,000 soldiers in the United States Army. So I've been very privileged to have strong female leaders in my life besides different races, especially on the state police. I've had so many great different races, but one that stands out in particular as a Black leader in my life is retired Lieutenant Colonel Stallworth with the state police, who saw something different in me and pushed me out of my comfort zone.
Between your experience in the career and then also your personal experience, how do you find this balance between being a Black man, being a police chief, and solving crimes affecting Black people while still trying to gain their trust to serve and protect?
So I don't have a problem with trust in the Black community. Every citizen in Champaign and more have my direct cell phone number. If there's something going on, they give me a call. If they have questions, they call. And I spend a lot of time with everyone. There's many lunch and dinner dates and things that I go on. People know my family, like they're around my kids and wife. So as far as building that trust in the Black community, it is what it is. Like, do we have, bad cops? Yes. You know who hate bad cops more than regular citizens? Good cops. I mean, we don't like it. We're the most regulated profession there is. We know it. And I look at my police officers. I see the scenes that they go to when they're trying to rescue little kids that are being killed and they're giving mouth to mouth, or when they're on the scene with a shooting, or when they go to a horrible situation where a child has been neglected and abused. And you talk to them, they got on all this gear that you see me on, but they put their head on my shoulder and just cry. I really would like for people to know that police officers are not robots, and we're beginning to see it with the suicide rate in law enforcement right now is increased to the worst it's ever been. So I ask that the community to pray for all police officers, because when we go home, we can't unring the bell with some of the things that we see. And we see the worst of the worst.
There was a recent shooting in Champaign where two teens were killed. In these types of events, how do you help calm the community and hear their concerns?
Well, the community help calms me. People getting killed, especially babies, it's not right. It's not right. It's final, right? To see how the mothers and the fathers struggle. I've been in law enforcement for 31 years. 31. And the hardest conversation I've ever had is when I had to talk to the mothers from the organization Cry for Help. And I wanted to fix their problems. I wanted to get them justice. I want to get them justice. And I want to bring their kids back. But it's such a long process. Until you have actually sat in the room with 7 or 8 mothers of their kids they can't bring back, it's horrible. So with our 2 teenagers being killed, shot on Colleen Drive, and then the 2 that we lost that horrible, horrible night, that Sunday morning, I will never forget the mom and the anguish and the dad and the pain and almost 200 community members that flocked to the hospital and was just crying in the rain. But I was getting phone calls from community members at 3 o'clock in the morning. Are you okay? The people who really know me know my heart. I mean, I remember talking to one particular community member at 3:40 in the morning as I was driving home because he was hurting, I was hurting, and we comforted each other. So yeah, it hurts the entire community. So I'm going to spend the rest of my career focusing on Black murders. I was just looking at the numbers the other day from a 2022 FBI report that almost 11,000 African-Americans are killed by African-Americans each year. We have a real issue that we need to focus on.
With that being said, with focusing on the rest of your career with Black-on-Black violence, what does that look like for you?
It's making it known. It's getting these great opportunities to come on, you know, WIL and speak about it because I could care less about traffic. I could care less about this. I could care less. But what I really want to focus on is almost 11,000 people not being around, just families being disrupted forever. I think it's time out to stop playing with topics, right? I want us, especially in the Black community, to focus on eliminating almost 11,000 people dying every year. And we need to just point the blame where the blame need to be pointed. We need to love on our community, stop this violence, and really focus on, I'm a Christian, so I'm going to say it, really focusing on living for Christ and being what we were created to be, children of God.
The city of Champaign started a gun violence prevention program in February of 2022. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Let me tell you about the city of Champaign. First of all, I am still learning law enforcement. If you ever find anybody who calls themselves a subject matter expert, you need to question that. So I came to the city with over 29 years of experience in law enforcement, federal, state, and local before I got here. Our city, the city of Champaign, and the leaders, they put their money where their mouth is. I mean, over $7 million invested in this gun violence reduction blueprint, where not only are we focusing on the root cause, which is the most important, why are we shooting each other? Why are we still having all this abuse in the Black community? But also sending money to people that need the help. We have meetings that we concentrate on the citizens and their quality of life. But this gun reduction blueprint should be a blueprint for every community, but every community cannot afford this blueprint. And we're pouring a lot of money into the community and also with our community members, with our addresses. There's so much going on in Champaign regarding poverty and hungry, and this city is leaning forward as far as they can to help. Where most people will want raises for their employees, the city of Champaign is like, we're putting it back to the citizens, the people that really need help.
When the 2 teens passed away, what was that press conference like with the community?
Well, one, it was unity, right? But it was almost too late. 2 had died. But the good part about the community members that are there, they're always there, right? Like, we have the community coalition meeting. These are the same 150 people that I see all the time, members of the NAACP, member of, you know, the faith community, members of, I mean, just everyone. But it's still just the 150, right? There's 89,000 people in Champaign, and there's about 150 that's carrying a load, which is not good. We need more people to get involved. We need more volunteers. we need more people to work with the city, just because I hear everyone talk and we all got the same goals, but the only problem we get hung up on is the direction that we're going.
Do you feel like the unity is there?
The unity is there. Like I said, I'm 2 years now, and when something major happened, my phone rings the entire day and night, or text messages, because community members are reaching out. They want to do coffee with a cop, or they want to volunteer, or what can we do to help? So that's what I'm seeing from the Black community, that they want to help. We probably have the most diverse police department we've had in 163 years. It says a lot, because we want to reflect our community.
It's been 10 years since Michael Brown and 4 years since George Floyd. And now we see what happened to Sonya Massey in our own state of Illinois. What are your thoughts on the Sonya Massey case?
So yeah, we had an officer-involved shooting. So it is state protocol mandated by our Illinois Congress that an outside police agency that is called in. So that's what happened. The supervisors at the scene end up calling the Illinois State Police. And they came out and investigated the crime, collected evidence. They brought out their crime scene services. I know how the state police operate. I am a former state police colonel, right? But what people don't understand about law enforcement is that we cannot charge for most felonies. Like, we have to get the approval through the state's attorney office. The state's attorney from Sangamon County did exactly, reviewed the cases, and they applied charges, first-degree murder, and some other charges with the new Safety Act. All police officers, including me, you can see my body cam, are required to wear a body cam where this officer did not have on his body cam. So when they presented the case to the state's attorney office, they came up with the charges and he was arrested. That is the process, right? Justice is the most important thing that we have. And I am very careful to talk about cases because I want justice to be done. But I am so proud of the process thus far and the changes that we have made in law enforcement for accountability. And I can speak on behalf of my police department. We're happy for the accountability. Community members have the right to, you know, really understand what we're doing.
In talking about accountability in the Sonya Massey case, of course, the public wants to see accountability for Sean.
Police Grace. Officers. Mm-hmm. Wants to see accountability. So we're from the public, like none of us are flown in from Mars to police this community. Like, we want to see accountability too.
Mm-hmm. Before we even get to needing to have accountability for the police brutality that we see on mass media and in our local communities, it's still a question of the public after everything that he had, 2 misdemeanor DUIs, like 6 different law enforcement agencies that he was bouncing around to. We're talking about accountability, but before we even get to that, the question is, why was he even on the police force to begin with?
Every police department have their own hiring standards. Champaign Police is pretty tough. The state police is pretty tough. But we also got this organization called the Illinois Law Enforcement and Standard Board, and we enforce the rules. Police chiefs and managers, sheriffs and executive leaders, we enforce the rules of the Illinois Police and Training and Standard Board. So if there was no red flags, that's what we as police executives have to go by. We cannot overreach the law. There are some things that are administrative policies. There are some things that are criminal policies. We must enforce state law. What people don't understand, even with hiring folks, like, we must enforce the state law when it comes to hiring practices so that we're not violating people's due process when it comes to employment also.
After the media attention goes away, how do police officers make continued efforts to make things right for families that have been directly hurt from the violence and trauma?
We're there. You know, I'm pretty sure the police department is going to be upset with me after I explain what they do. When something major happened with some of our community members, our police officers, they go in their pockets. I remember a bad situation where a 5-year-old was abused and it was his birthday the next day. Besides the tears that they dropped for this 5-year-old kid, they all reached in their pockets, went to the hospital with him, stayed at the hospital with him. And the next day, they gave him the biggest 5-year-old birthday that you could ever have. That's the part that I know, because this department, my department, the city's department, they don't want to be recognized for that because, one, they're just human beings. And so every opportunity they give to pour into community members. I remember the year that I got here, a young 5 or 6 year old had been shot. Again, they all, without any direction from the police chief or anything, made sure that that kid was celebrated. And they keep in touch with these children throughout their whole life. So we're trying on our part, and I hope they're not upset with me for telling how big their heart is. But people need to know that story, too. They need to know that they cry. So what we're doing with our department is we're building that mental health program for our department. We've brought in guest speakers. We've brought in training. So if I can do anything on this show today, I would just ask for the community members, pray for police. Like, we need it more than ever. It's a tough job. This is my last police job. I've seen a lot.
In Champaign?
Yes. More than what I thought I was going to see.
Where do you think this country is headed in terms of advancing racial justice?
I don't know. I know with me, I just spend time with the most multicultural human being there is, and that's Jesus Christ every day. And I spend time praying to him, and I am going to do his will, and I am going to pray for this nation that we always put God first. There's stories in the Bible, when you turn away from God, the nation falls. And for every elected government official, every public appointed official, every government employee, God has chosen us to help him govern. And that is a true responsibility that we cannot take lightly.
Chief Timothy Tyler, thank you so much for joining me for this dialogue.
Thank you.
That was Police Chief of Champaign, Chief Timothy Tyler. He just shared with us his experiences of balancing his role as a chief, running Champaign's police department, and his connection with the Black community. It's a duality that Chief Boone also faced, who we spoke with earlier in this conversation. They both shared their perspectives on the Sonia Massey case in Springfield, Illinois, and policing in our neighboring towns of Champaign and Urbana. Coming up next, we're speaking with Alicia Lewis, who is a PhD student and researcher at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign with the Department of Political Science. She shares how her research of racial trauma from police violence affects our minds, bodies, and spirits. You're listening to Dialogue. Stay with us as we take this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. This episode contains sensitive recounts of police brutality, racial trauma, and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we've been in conversation with Police Chief Larry Boone of Urbana and Police Chief Timothy Tyler of Champaign. They shared their perspectives on managing our local police departments and the trust they're building with our neighborhoods. Now, we're sitting down with University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign PhD student and researcher at the Department of Political Science, Alicia Lewis. Her work and research studies how racial trauma from police violence affects our minds, bodies, and spirits. Alicia Lewis is a Schrader Fellow at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Lewis's work uses statistical data to answer the question, to what extent does the race of a victim predict the likelihood of an outcome being fatal? She also focuses on the effects of Black racial trauma on political behavior. Alicia Lewis, thank you so much for joining me for this dialogue.
Of course, I'm happy to be here. So I'm a PhD student at UIUC. My work focuses primarily on Black politics, political psychology in the U.S. I mostly examine how racial trauma can shape political behavior, the way African Americans engage politically.
So break down the racial trauma that we can see and how it affects politics.
Yeah, with racial trauma, it's complicated because it's so fundamentally different than trauma that stems from other experiences. Because when we talk about trauma, we talk about things like assault and domestic violence. And that's normally that there is something that happens to you that affects the way you see yourself, the way you see the world in general, the way you behave on a day-to-day basis. With a racial trauma, it's like those effects are still there, but it's not just because of one thing. It's the accumulation of multiple experiences over the course of your lifetime. So it's microaggressions, it's negative encounters with the police, it's having to deal with racism so many times throughout your lifetime that can produce this trauma response. And depending on where it's coming from, that can affect whether you are willing to engage in politics and how you're willing to engage. Because some people are just completely demobilized and decide that there's nothing that they can really do. But other people have the opposite response and think, no, I'm angry and I hate this. And so I'm going to do something about it. And so in a way, that mobilizes them depending on the experience.
Can we talk about a trauma response to racial injustice that we personally experience? And then can we talk about when we tune into Instagram and TikTok and the news and we're seeing someone being shot by police who is supposed to serve and protect and provide justice in our system? What type of trauma is that causing for us to see this on the screen day to day?
Yeah, so the most common type of racial trauma that people experience is direct. It's something that happens to you specifically that you experience yourself. And the way that that comes up can be biologically. It affects you health-wise in the long term. It can increase your heart rate. It can increase stress hormones in your body and really take a toll on you over time. And so we'll often see that African Americans and groups of color often have a higher rate of all of these like chronic diseases and all of these things. It's partially because of that. On more of a psychological level, it can affect the way you think and the way you act in the sense that you may avoid certain people, places, or things that remind you of the negative experiences that you have. It could affect your worldview in the sense that you may just think that the world in general is an unsafe place, especially for people who are like you. You may feel anxious or even have nightmares if you think about a specific experience that really traumatized you. We see this with people all the time. I've even heard from people who are parents, especially, that they not only have those kinds of experiences, but they take those and instill them in their children. Not trying to be harmful at all, but it's the sort of thing where Black parents kind of teach their kids almost the rules of being Black, how you behave. So when you get pulled over by the police, this is what you do. You look straight ahead, you be polite, you keep your hands on the wheel. Like that, in a sense, is a trauma response because they've either been through something themselves or they've heard about someone else going through something similar. And so they try to protect the people around them from having those sorts of experiences as well.
So even though we have our aunties and uncles and moms and dads trying to protect us from these experiences, it's also having those sit down conversations that instills a certain type of trauma, fear around these institutions that we're supposed to trust.
Yeah, I mean, in a practical sense, it can be helpful in the sense that you know how to act given the situation. But also you kind of internalize it in the sense that first, that something like that could happen to you, and just knowing that that's even a possibility can be very stressful to think about. I personally, I don't drive. And it's pretty much for that reason. I'm afraid of what would happen if I get pulled over. And so I just take public transit and I take Ubers, and I personally don't even really risk it. And so it's understandable why those lessons are there, but the long-term impact of it can be positive or it can be negative.
What does this racial trauma look like long term to the human body, to the human spirit?
We often see is that people who have significant racial trauma have this sense of a narrowing sense of time. It's like they struggle to see their own future, because in some sense, it's like they don't know if they'll have one. But even if they do, they worry about what quality of life they'll have down the line, because they think that racism is just a part of their life experience as it relates to their identity. It's not really something that they can get away from. Because if you think about it, we have police shootings now as a very contemporary source of racial trauma. But even if you look at historical acts of racism, you can look at something like slavery or Jim Crow or all of these other things. It's easy to see that and think racism has always been around long before me, and it probably will long after me. What's the point, essentially?
With that question, what's the point? Do you think that creates a type of numbness in our culture, in our society that we're seeing?
When you have incidents like police shootings happen, people are kind of desensitized to it almost, because it happens so often now, especially in the U.S. It can create the sense of numbness to where you don't even really react to it, or you may even try to actively push it away and not even bother trying to stay informed about things like this, because after a while it can feel like it's all the same. It's like they all blur together. It's like there's just another person who was shot. It's like if you knock down one domino, there's still gonna be 10 more that pop up again. And it's like, how are we actually supposed to resolve this? Is this just our lives now?
How do we deal with all of this?
I mean, I think probably what I would recommend is essentially to channel it. When we talk about coping, there are two different types. One of them is emotion-focused coping, and that's just all about how you feel. And so that could be doing yoga, that could be meditating, that could be traveling. It's not about the situation that you're actually coping with. It's just about making you feel better on an emotional and psychological level. And then the other side of that is more problem-focused coping. So if you are fearful or angry or sad about what the police are doing, then honestly get involved politically, because you're not just supposed to sit by passively and just kind of watch things crumble around you. You can, but no one should feel like they necessarily have to.
As a Black woman and as a professional who studies and researches police violence, can you break down what happened to Sonya Massey?
So essentially what happened is that she heard something outside of her house. She thought it may have been a prowler or someone trying to break in. And so she called the police for help. And so there were two officers who arrived at her doorstep, and they knocked for a few minutes and she didn't answer, but eventually she did. And she was a bit apprehensive. She seemed a bit scared, but they said, "Oh, you don't need to be scared. You called us. Why would you be afraid?" And so they were talking to her, and they kind of went around and circled the house to see if they could find anything. And they didn't find anyone out by the house, but they saw that there was like a car nearby where like a window was broken. And so they went to go ask her about it, which she didn't know anything about because it wasn't her car. But they ended up going inside just to talk to her more about the situation. And there was a pot of boiling water on the stove. And so the boiling water, it was going, and one of the officers said, like, "Oh, you should take the water off. Like, we don't need a fire in here," or something along those lines. And so she went to go take the water off, and they were saying something, and she said, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." She said it twice, and the officer said, "You better not, or I'll kill you now," or something to that effect. And he told her to put the water down, which she did. And then as she was getting back up, she put her hands up and He shot her 3 times and she went down. And this officer went to go get a medical kit to give her aid after she was shot. And the person who shot her said, no, she's already gone. Don't bother.
Seeing that personally, how did that make you feel as a Black woman?
I honestly was not very surprised. I wasn't surprised by most of it. The thing that I think shocked me a bit was like when she said, I rebuke you in the name of Jesus, the way he reacted to that and how aggressive he was, it sounded like he thought it was a threat, which it wasn't. But that phrase, I feel like, is so common in the African-American community. People say that all the time, especially in religious contexts, like when they're in church, especially like older Black ladies will say it. It kind of seemed like she just said a relatively common phrase that he wasn't familiar with, and he misinterpreted it as a threat, and she died because of it. And I don't know what to do with that necessarily. The fact that differences in vernacular between a Black person and a white person could lead to someone dying is so surreal to me. It's like I can't really fathom it.
What does grief look like during this time? And what does healing look like during this time?
I mean, grief looks like a lot of sadness. It's confusion over why this happened and also why this is just a regular thing that seems to never really be resolved. It's a lot of anger and frustration that this is still something that we're dealing with that happens a lot and happens everywhere. It's really hard to escape this kind of thing. And knowing that can make you go through a sort of grieving process. It's almost like you're grieving your own safety in a sense. Because if you're a Black person or someone who is statistically more likely to have something like this happen to you, there are a lot of negative emotions that come with that that can be pretty difficult to deal with. If you want to heal on a personal level, then there are things that you can do. I know several people who smoke, which I would not necessarily recommend. Healthy behaviors only. I interviewed some people who also said that they like to pray if you are a religious or a spiritual person. It's also therapeutic really just to talk about it openly, especially with people who you think understand. So if there is a shooting or if there is something happening that is really negatively affecting you and making you feel as if because of my race, this may happen to me and I may have these awful experiences more or less for the rest of my life. That's not the kind of thing that you should keep to yourself, because even just discussing what's going on and how you're feeling is something that can be immensely therapeutic, and those who really love you and care can really be there for you.
Alicia Lewis, thank you so much for joining me in this dialogue today.
Of course. Thank you so much for inviting me.
The Dialogue team would like to thank our guests, Police Chief Larry Boone, Police Chief Timothy Tyler, and PhD student and researcher Alicia Lewis for joining us on this dialogue. There's more to hear in this dialogue. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul for an extended version and part 2 of this conversation coming soon. You can find the Dialogue podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. This episode of Dialogue was produced by Nidhi Shastri, Penny Bradford, Troy McDonald, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.